or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is P. Fitz, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from current issues of the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Target hints at challenging holiday season. From the Associated Press, New York. Target's third quarter profit tumbled as the retailer struggles to lure shoppers that are being pressed by stubbornly high inflation and grappling with other. The Minneapolis company said Wednesday that it expects its sales to slump to extend through the sales slump to extend through the critical holiday shopping season. The economy also announced that it's planning to invest another $1 billion next year to remodel stores and build new ones, increasing the total cost for the makeover to $5 billion. Investors have punished Target's stock recently, sending it down 43% over the last year. Shares edged lower before the opening bell. Turning around the 19% profit side in the most recent quarter is the latest challenge to incoming CEO Michael Fiddelke, a 20-year company veteran who is replacing CEO Brian Cornell on February 1st. The handover arrives as the retailer tries to reverse and to revive its reputation as the place to go for affordable but stylish products. Target's troubles stand in stark contrast to rival Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, which is thriving. Walmart reports on its most recent quarterly performance Thursday. Target announced in October that it was eliminating about 1,800 corporate positions in an effort to streamline decision-making and to accelerate initiatives to rebuild the flagging customer base. The cuts represent about 8% of Target's corporate workforce. To pump up sales, Target is offering more than 20,000 new items, twice as many as last year, and it has lowered prices on thousands of food, beverage, and essential items. We have high but achievable aspirations for Target's future, and we're acting urgently to make the changes and investments, Fiddelke told reporters on Tuesday. With about 1,980 U.S. stores, Target has struggled to find its footing since inflation caused pinched shoppers to curtail their discretionary spending. Customers have complained of messy stores with merchandise that did not reflect the expensive-looking but budget-priced niche that long ago earned the retailer jokingly posh nickname Target. Boycotts since late January, when Target joined rival Walmart and a number of other prominent American brands in scaling back its corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, have compounded the predicament. Retailers have spent almost 11 months navigating President Donald Trump's wide-ranging tariffs on imports and his immigration crackdown that threatened to shrink supply of workers. The just-ended 43-day federal shutdown is expected to be another drag on the economy, though its full impact will take months to measure. Government contract awards have slowed, and many food aid recipients have seen their benefits interrupted. Fiddelke told reporters that the company saw a weaker September, but he said it was tricky for us to isolate the different factors behind that. The retailer's profit fell to $689 million in the three-month period ending November 1st, or $1.51 per share. That compares with $854 million or $1.85 per share just a year ago. Adjusted analysts expected profits of $1.71 per share on sales of $25.33 billion. Comparable sales, those from established physical stores and online channels, dipped 2.7% in the latest three-month period. That's more than the 1.9% drop in the previous quarter and marks the third straight quarterly decline. Sale gains in food and beverages were offset by continued weakness in discretionary goods, with anxious shoppers focused increasingly on buying essentials, even on holiday goods. But the company said recent efforts to revamp sporting goods, toys, and tech gadgets have spurred stronger sales. From the opinion column, Staying Alive, Staying Alive, by Ed Adamczyk. It was not long ago that a mysterious pandemic ravaged the earth. People wore masks to forestall infections, and others did not because death was God's determination. They regarded themselves as divine messengers or something, and it was their First Amendment right to contaminate others. And plans, goals, and schedules were disrupted until over 1 million Americans died and the matter was brought under some control. Among those who needed to adjust to new realities was the Toronto Blue Jays baseball team, whose homeland was essentially locked down due to shuttered border crossings. So it played several weeks of its home schedule in Buffalo, and I attended the prominent teams, and my strongest memory was that I paid $97 for a seat, for which I'd pay $12 if it were a Bisons game. The Yankees and the Red Sox came through Buffalo that season to play the Blue Jays. I did not even ask the cost of those tickets. Sir Paul McCartney, age 83, performed last week where the Sabres normally play, and it was, by accounts, a tightly produced, satisfying roll down memory lane for the 18,000 or so who attended, with smoke still rising from their credit cards. I did not inquire about the ticket prices, which in other cities range from $350 to roughly half a Lexus, but it made me wonder the why of all of this. Until Beyonce and Jay-Z came along, Beatle Paul, the cute one, the songwriter with the left-hand strung bass guitar, was regarded as the richest living person in show business. Apparently in good health, that's vegetarian living for you. He could be writing his memoirs, playing with his grandchildren, counting his money in his Scottish castle, or writing more highly melodic songs in that style that's gone out of style. But no, he's on the road across North America. He will perform in Hamilton, Ontario next week. The Beatles remain touchstone to my youth and the culture that influenced my life and approach to dealing with the world. So is The Who my favorite rock band of that era? and what's left of them is on the road now as well. Its leader, Pete Townsend, is a grizzled survivor at 80 who has admitted dragging his ensemble through tours simply for the money. Those from the modern rock era, with their heads and bodies more or less intact, have found an old age revenue stream. So who attended the McCartney show? I was not there, but I would suspect a lot of shiny heads, a lot of Republicans, and people who hope to show their grandchildren what all the fuss was about circa 1964 and after. You may have caught the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra that weekend earlier, or either doing their tribute to Green Day, a 90s era band whose work was later brought to Broadway in the musical American Idiot, or a tribute to Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and other female singers of the era. The BPO's Green Day show was loud and sparsely attended, but the concert honoring the Lady Rockers was a hit. Score another one for the boomers. The Green Day fans are at home, still paying off their student loans, while the old-timers have discovered a new way to reel in what money some say regard as the best years of their lives. Retention of memory is a big deal for the rapidly aging, but even that is malleable. I once explained to someone how YouTube works. He mentioned an obscure Long Island band he once saw in Albany sometime in the 80s. He found their work on the internet. I played him one song on my portable Mac, and he was pleased to hear it again. Other people need a room full of memorabilia, a dislike for anything not of their era, and the means to afford tickets to see and hear McCartney in concert. I can make a list of prominent rockers I not only saw in concert, but while they were at their best, and no, Sir Paul is not on it. These tributes to past glory are not for me. I will settle for a summer night in 1968 when I saw The Who at Melody Fair, a big tent masquerading as a tiny concert venue in North Tonawanda, where the worst seat in the place was 40 feet from the stage. Sweat poured down, music rang out, and you could have heard that drummer and, yes, instruments and amplifiers were satisfyingly wrecked. You remember nights like that long after you remember how hard you worked to afford the tickets. You can contact Ed Adamczyk at edinkenmore@gmail.com. Suit seeks unspecified damages for deaths of Grand Island couple. The estate of a Grand Island couple killed in an explosive accident on the Rainbow Bridge the day before Thanksgiving in 2023 has filed a suit against the manufacturer of the luxury car and the Michigan auto dealership that sold it to them. A lawyer for the estate accuses Bentley Motors Incorporated, Bentley Motors Limited, Volkswagen Group in America, Volkswagen AG, Suburban Exotic Motor Cars of Michigan LLC, and Troy Exotics LLC of negligent, reckless, careless, and unlawful conduct in the death of Kurt P. and Monica Villani. The couple, both 53, were the owners of Guy's Lumber and 7 Ace Hardware stores in Western New York. The cause of the crash has never officially been determined. The Niagara Falls Police Department's Crash Management Unit ended its investigation into the crash which was first thought to have been the possible terrorist attack on the international border crossing between the U.S. and Canada without reaching a final determination of what happened. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Sources close to the investigation have cited the complete and total destruction of the black box data recorder on board the Volani's 2022 Bentley Flying Spur, and a complete lack of cooperation from the car's manufacturers, factors that stymied the crash management unit's efforts. Falls police officials have said that the investigation of the crash could be reopened if new evidence becomes available. In its lawsuit, the Volani estate alleges that the vehicle being driven by Kurt malfunctioned, causing it to experience sudden acceleration, unintended acceleration, brake system failure, brake failure, and or otherwise prevented the driver from controlling the subject vehicle, causing said vehicle to suddenly, unexpectedly, and without warning accelerate to an extremely high rate of speed. Crash investigators said a review of video evidence amassed by the Niagara Falls Intelligence and Crime Analysis Center in Niagara Falls showed the Volani's car traveling down Niagara Street toward the bridge. The vehicle, investigators said, appeared to be traveling at a very high rate of speed, estimated as high as 130 miles an hour, as it entered the bridge plaza on the toll booth side of where cars were backed up entering Canada. As the car came into the plaza, surveillance and security camera video shows it veered sharply into a concrete barrier, which then caused it to go airborne over an 8-foot-high chain-link fence. A 5-second clip of video released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, taken by the bridge security camera, shows the Volani's car speeding onto the entrance of the bridge, striking the concrete barrier, and then going airborne. The video did not show the impact of the vehicle from in front of the customs inspections booths. Witnesses on the bridge said the car pancaked onto the plaza pavement and exploded into a ball of flames and smoke that destroyed one of the customs border protection booths, a CPB officer inside the booth escaped the destruction with only minor injuries. A second clip showed a fireball shooting into the air in front of the booths. The debris field on the bridge covered a wide area on the customs inspection side of the border crossing. The luxury car exploded into thousands of pieces and twisted metal that shattered glass and melted plastic. The recovered parts of the vehicle were described as enough to fill a construction dumpster, but crash investigators said much of the vehicle was incinerated in the heat of the fire that engulfed the car. In a laundry list of claims against Bentley and its parent company Volkswagen, the Volani estate alleges that the vehicle manufacturer failed to adequately, properly, and sufficiently design and manufacture the car. The lawsuit also claims the Bentley and Volkswagen failed to equip the subject vehicle with safety devices in the event of sudden acceleration, unintended acceleration, or the failure of the braking system and or brakes. The suit points out that the auto manufacturer had conducted a recall of flying spurs in Australia and the United Kingdom to address instances of stuck accelerator pedals, but it did not do the same in the United States. Grant funding, very competitive, experts say. Residents call on city officials to seek out more grant opportunities. This is by Heidi Truschel, Light. Residents at a recent Common Council meeting suggested the city secure a grant writer to go after the free money available in grants. Speaking to elected officials, resident Lenny Thomas said that the city should find a grant writer to work on funding proposals and to be paid with a percentage of the award. Another resident described grant as free money just sitting out there. After a question from resident Steve Huston, or Houston, about whether the city has a grant writer, Mayor John Lombardi III replied that the city did not, but the Greater Lockport Development Corporation did. Grants may not be as readily available as community members believe, according to those involved in the funding process. The limited purpose of a grant, eligibility restrictions, application requirements, resources needed, and timing of award funding can all work for or against municipality or organization's ability to obtain money. Starting with the basics, Beth Gosch, executive director of West New York Foundation in Buffalo, said grants can come from multiple funding avenues. Grants, government grants at the federal, state, and county and city levels are somewhat sophisticated processes to go through. Right now, under current circumstances, those revenue streams are very unpredictable, Gosch said. There's a lot of changing priorities and a lot of chaos resulting from funding cuts. Philanthropic foundations, which can be community foundations or private foundations, oversee grant programs to charities within certain focus areas. They have funds where the donees have very specific criteria for how funds can get dispersed. Gosh. The Western New York Foundation's mission is to support organizations driving a transformative change in the regional food system. The demand for money is much greater than the supply of money, Gosch said. Just because people apply doesn't mean you'll get the grant. These foundations can't accommodate all the requests they receive. Scrolling through online grant listings reveals that whether for government or charitable organizations, most grants are restricted to certain locations and don't consider applicants from elsewhere. Chris Smith, executive director of the Craig Lewis Foundation of Lockport, said the private foundation restricts its funding to Niagara County. We prefer not to fund tax-supported organizations, Smith said. We are only allowed to fund federal 501c3 organizations. Maureen Henderson, director of the Niagara Small Business Development Center, helps people establish small businesses and directs them towards support. The grants that we work with are all location-based. They're by municipality with state funds from the public community block grants, Henderson said. The grants aren't always available. They are very well regulated. It's not just filling out an application. They almost all require a business plan and some financial projections. Thomas Tsai, coordinator of economic development for the Town of Lockport Industrial Development Agency, has been writing grant proposals to state agencies for years. He said many grants are announced once a year. You usually have 30 days when the application is open, Tsai said. Grants typically do not provide funds for overall city spending, Tsai said. I've never seen a grant for general, non-specific municipal funds. You have to fund a program or a service. I've never seen a general support kind of scenario. Most grants aren't multi-purpose, Tsai said, but are limited to specific purposes, such as certain waterline projects or park development. He said the 30-day time frame requires that the potential project is nearly fully planned, often with time and money spent already spent on the engineering plans. Anything that's fly by the seat of your pants is not going to get picked. Grants are very competitive, he said, with applicants from across the state. Further, Tsai said, another type of government grant comes from applications to local legislators. Congress and the state legislature set aside a budget for member items to fund, he said. Even in difficult years, it's rare that member item pots for funds don't exist, he said. On the federal side, it's somewhat similar. It's difficult around here to get money from the state legislators. We've applied to Congressman Tenney a number of times. She tends to award projects more than $1 million, so that might have been for a new fire hall or water treatment plant. From the Union Sun and Journal mailbag. These are opinions. Let us focus on shared good fortune. President Lincoln issued his Thanksgiving proclamation on October 3rd, 1863, during the Civil War. Lincoln hoped to promote healing and gratitude in a war-weary nation. Our country was deeply divided in an effort of national unity. Lincoln declared a Thanksgiving celebration of shared good fortune during even the hardest of times. Thanksgiving was intended to provide hope to those on both sides of the Mason-Dixon suffering a terrible loss from the war. The romantic idea of the first Thanksgiving, a coming together of pilgrims and Native Americans for a bountiful feast after a devastating first year of the Plymouth Colony, is the ideal historic foundation for Lincoln's proclaimed holiday. The U.S. Civil War, as well as the Native American experience, are painful histories that continue to be felt to this day. And today, we once again find fractures in our Union. We are being warned of the enemy from within, while others clamor that some people are getting what they voted for. I'm not buying either of these narratives. I do not believe that an entire political party, nearly one half of our country, is the enemy from within. Nor do I believe that anyone is getting what they voted for, when it feels like our country is falling further into disrepair, or despair, sorry. This Thanksgiving, somewhere between the feasting and the football, let's heed Lincoln's original proclamation. Provide comfort to those who are suffering, acknowledge our difficult past, and look ahead to a shared good fortune and healing of our nation. That was from Lisa Casey of Lockport. Let USPS deliver your holidays. As the Lockport postmaster, my team and I are here to help your holiday cards and gifts move to their destination without a hitch. The Postal Service's recent modernization efforts, practical changes in how we sort, stage, and dispatch align us with leading logistical practices to best deliver your holidays. A few quick tips: confirm your addresses, including zip codes and apartment or suite numbers. Choose the right service, USPS Ground Advantage for value, Priority Mail for speed, and Priority Mail Express when timing is critical. Be aware for recommended ship-by dates. Be aware of recommended ship-by dates and visit USPS.com for all your mailing and shipping needs. As always, ship early. This year, our recommended ship-by dates for expected holiday delivery within the continental U.S. before December 25th are December 17th for USPS Ground Advantage service, first class mail service, December 18th, priority mail service, December 20th, priority mail express service. We're focused on dependable performance for every address we serve. Thanks for trusting the United States Postal Service this holiday season. Postmaster Seth Samucha. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Suspected serial killer sentenced to 40 years to life. Remains a person of interest in Niagara Falls homicide investigation, by Rick Pfeiffer, Lockport Journal. Buffalo. A man suspected of being a possible serial killer will spend 40 years to life in a state prison for the murder of two Buffalo women. But he remains a person of interest in the grisly discovery of the skeletal remains of another woman in the stairwell of a Niagara Falls home where he once worked as a handyman. Richard J. Fox, 62, of Buffalo, was sentenced to 40 years to life in prison in Erie County Court on Friday. Fox's sentence stems from his guilty plea to two counts of second-degree murder in connection with the cold case slayings of Cassandra Watson and Marquita Mull. Watson is believed to have been killed in Buffalo sometime between 2003 and 2004, while Mull was likely murdered there in June of 2021. Despite his status as a person of interest in an apparent Niagara Falls homicide, Niagara County prosecutors have stressed that there are no charges currently pending against Fox here. On September 26, 2021, a hiker walking along Chautauqua trails near Wolobin Road in the town of Portland had discovered the remains of a human skull. A forensic analysis determined that the skeletal remains had been buried at the site for more than a decade. The following day, September 27th, 2021, investigators discovered Mull's body in a shallow grave as they excavated the site where Watson's remains had been discovered. Both women were reported to have been involved in relationships with Fox, a registered sex offender. Fox was arrested on January 7th as he walked in the 1000 block of Portage Road in the Falls. He was taken into custody by Falls Police, Narcotics and Intelligence Division detective, and a Falls detective assigned to the U.S. Marshals Violent Fugitive Task Force. Falls Police said investigators with the Chautauqua County Sheriff's Office and the Buffalo Police Department had contacted them for assistance in locating Fox, who, although he was from Buffalo, was living in the Falls at the time. From the time of his arrest, law enforcement sources have said that Fox was a suspect in other unsolved crimes, including possible homicides. On March 28th, detectives from the Falls Police Criminal Division, along with Buffalo Police Homicide Squad and Chautauqua County Sheriff's Office investigators, executed a search warrant at an apartment building at 2419, Orleans Avenue. A search of the apartment building led to the discovery of what was described as the badly decomposed remains of a woman under a stairwell and enclosed in the drywall. Law enforcement sources later confirmed that Fox had lived in the apartment in the Orleans Avenue building, and he had worked as a handyman for a former owner of the property. Just over a week after the discovery of the victim, on April 8th, Falls and Buffalo police detectives and New York State police investigators executed additional search warrants at locations on Pierce, Pine, and LaSalle Avenues. In the 1100 block of Pierce Avenue, investigators also seized and towed away a white Chevy Express utility van parked behind a residence. Sources said the van was linked to Fox. Law enforcement sources with knowledge of the ongoing investigation said Falls Police Crime Scene Unit detectives were able to recover DNA evidence from the unknown victim. CID detectives have reportedly been working to identify the victim. In May, Falls Police conducted a forensic dig in the backyard of the Orleans Avenue building, but did not turn up any additional evidence. Tips on navigating holiday travel at the border. Increased traffic expected. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is expecting an increased in border traffic for the upcoming holiday season and is reminding travelers who are planning trips to anticipate some delays due to increased traffic and plan accordingly. Travelers looking for ways to improve their travel experience should consider the following tips. Utilize the appropriate travel document, passports, U.S. visas, lawful permanent resident cards, U.S. passport cards, and enhanced driver's licenses are a few of the approved documents. You can obtain more information by contacting the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. Visa Waiver Program, the VWP. Travelers looking to enter the United States at land ports of entry are required to obtain an approved electronic system for travel authorization prior to seeking admission. If you arrive without a valid travel authorization, you will not be admitted and will need to return to Canada to complete the application and await processing of your application. You can find more information on that by reaching out to Electronic System for Travel Authorization. Check border wait times. Plan ahead, give yourself extra time. You can check traffic conditions at the border crossings within your region and select a crossing that is least congested. Travelers can download CBP's Border Wait Time app to their mobile devices to check crossing traffic conditions. Travelers can also obtain traffic conditions at www.cbp.gov/travel/advisories-wait-times. If possible, travel during non-peak travel times. Peak travel times generally tend to be between the hours of 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. If you are able, leaving the night before is one way to avoid peak travel delays. Prepare for the inspection process before arriving at the inspection booth. Have your travel documents in hand, roll down the vehicle windows, and remove hats and sunglasses before entering the inspection area. Travelers are encouraged to visit the Know Before You Go section of the CBP website. To avoid lines and penalties associated with importation of restricted or prohibited items, become educated prior to traveling. This includes agricultural products. Please visit the www.cbp.gov travel. And remember, marijuana remains illegal in the U.S. federally. Do not cross the border with any marijuana or marijuana products. Westher offers local Colvin Cleaners coats for kids drop-off sites. Live collection event coming up at Lockport Subaru store on December 8th. Wester Auto Group has joined the 30th annual Colvin Cleaners Coats for Kids program. Donations of slightly used or new winter coats, gloves, hats, scarves, and boots will be accepted at more than 60 Wester Auto Group locations in Western New York, Rochester, and Syracuse. Specially designed coats for kid barrels will be placed in each location. Local drop sites include Allstate at 10165 Niagara Falls Boulevard, Value Home Centers, 6001 Porter Road, Allstate 570-0A South Transit Road, Wester Transit Road, Wester all along Transit Road. There are about six sites. Our team has been overwhelmed by the number of requests for coats made on our website this past month. There's a website, www.coatsforkidswesternnewyork.com. Through the overwhelming generosity of so many families and organizations in our community, we have been able to fill those orders, but we are concerned because winter hasn't officially begun yet, said Christopher Bellani, Vice President of Colvin Cleaners. We offer free pickup and delivery to our dry cleaning customers and are able to pick up donations, but with the help of Wester, convenient locations in every neighborhood to donate to. Bellani said when Wester officials learned of the serious need for donations, they offered their locations and customer base to help the cause. In addition, Wester will host a live drive to collect winter coats and accessories from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on December 8th at its Subaru Lockport store, 6856 South Transit Road, Lockport. We are so appreciative of the team at Wester, led by Beth Hollis, VP for Variable Organizations Operations. Excuse me. To join our team to ensure we can keep children and families in need warm this winter. Each year, the need gets greater for coats, but we have been blessed with the ability to meet the demand, Bellani said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Lockport Union Sun and Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Girl, the Bee, and the Book That Endures. This is a commentary by Sharon Bailey. I imagine me as a little girl in elementary school with braids, bitten fingernails, and eyeglasses in the late 70s. In fourth or fifth grade, I sat on the Martin Luther Christian School stage with other students to compete in the school's spelling bee. The prize, a Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, 8th edition. After winning the school spelling bee, I moved on but was defeated at the regional level. It didn't matter. I won the dictionary, and on the inside cover was a Buffalo News book plate personalized with my name. Whenever I needed help with language or homework, a novel, a crossword puzzle, or a Scrabble game, I relied on the hefty crimson-colored book. The dictionary was a reliable companion for many years. My last dictionary purchase was in 2003. A Merriam-Webster published its Collegiate Dictionary 11th edition the same year. It's on my desk close by, and I use it all the time. Here is a bit of context. 2003 brought the Iraq War and the launch of the Department of Homeland Security, while late-night television welcomed Jimmy Kimmel alive. President Bush signed H.R. 3491, the act establishing the National Museum of African American History and Culture. 2003 also marked the selection of Merriam-Webster's first word of the year, the inaugural pick, democracy. Go figure. Because I adore dictionaries, I naturally purchased Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary 12th edition, which is the first hardback version in more than 20 decades, and was made available to the public on November 18th. When it arrives, I'll probably hug the box. Why does this updated edition mean so much to me? It highlights how much language is always shifting and developing. Even though the Merriam-Webster site had the 5,000 new words, nothing beats holding a new dictionary and looking up words like janky, of a very poor quality, and doomscroll. Think about the word doomscroll. I used it in a past column. The habit of compulsively scrolling through bad news online that also makes you feel bad has a name. We did it before we named it. Now the term is officially in the dictionary. A dictionary reflects our language back to us. These fresh editions prove dictionaries follow language rather than the reverse. In an era where basic facts are negotiable and alternative facts still not in the dictionary circulate like those change, the latest edition arrives just in time to remind us of what words actually mean. When AI or practical leaders spin out words that sound plausible yet do not exist, this is precisely the moment we need the heft of the dictionary in hand. We need a lexicon, a compendium with vocabulary whose meanings are agreed upon, researched, vetted, and real. In a sense, the dictionary has served as my language passport. With every word I learned, I was better able to read books, magazines, and newspapers. It helped set the stage for achievement in high school and college. It paved the way for me to write a weekly opinion column as a freelancer for two local papers. I look forward to unboxing the dictionary when it arrives. First, I will inspect the jacket and the book for any damage. After that, I will sniff the fresh paper and glue. I know I'm a little nerdy and weird, but judge, don't judge. Then I will open a page at random, seeing where chance will take me. Perhaps my finger will land on one of the 5,000 new words, or maybe it will be settle on a word I have known for 40 years that still means exactly what it always has. The revised 12th edition excludes biography, geography, and some obsolete terms. Still, my old copy isn't going anywhere. I may still it for Scrabble challenges, still use it for Scrabble challenges. This year, I'm thankful to Merriam-Webster for being the bridge between the spelling bee girl and the woman who writes a weekly opinion column. Meanwhile, I'll be looking out the window, waiting for her and wondering if Mr. Postman has a Merriam-Webster 12th edition in their bag for me. Cheers and jeers. This is from the Sun Union Times, Union Sun and Journal, comments about our times. Here come the holidays. Kicking things off was a popular Noel at Niagara Light tree lighting ceremony at Veterans Memorial Park in the town of Niagara. Helping to turn on the lights, Santa, the Grinch, Elf, Sabretooth, Rax, and Bandits from, and the Bandettes from the Bandits will be, Mickey Mouse, Olaf, and more will be on hand. The festivities are just the start of the part. The park will remain a winter holiday wonderland. Open Monday through Friday from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. through January 4th. For those wondering what to do on a Sunday night, right across the border, the Winter Festival of Lights on Niagara Falls is already underway. Celebrating its 43rd year as Canada's largest outdoor light festival. The free event lights up a five-mile stretch of Niagara Parkway with millions of twinkling lights, highlight, energy, laser light shows, fireworks, and more. While you can get some sense of it from our side, the trip across the border is well worth making to take in a real winter wonderland. The Winter Festival of Lights runs through January 4th. Another cheers. Christmas came early at Old Fort Niagara at the past village of Lewiston Meeting. Village historian Russell Piper gifted a portrait of Major Parmenio Adams, who was stationed at Fort Niagara from 1812 to 1813, before it was old, to Fort Executive Director Robert Emerson. Piper found the artwork at an estate sale back in September at the home of Adams' descendants. I wanted to preserve it because there is a lot of local history there, Piper said. And every piece I could find, could get my hands on, I bought to keep it. A Connecticut native who moved to Genesee County with his family in 1806. Adams served in the New York State Militia from 1806 to 16. He commanded a regiment of men from Genesee County. Neither Piper nor the Adams family knows who painted the portrait, only that their last name was Lang. They also guessed it was painted in either 1812 or 13 when Adams was on active duty. Emerson said he didn't know yet where the portrait would go, but we'll find a good place for it. In a jeer. It's always a sad day when a police or court report coming across your desk is related to animal abuse. This past week, we were sent two such reports that left us shaking our heads. The first involved a 30-year-old buffalo beating a 9-year-old chihuahua named Bella so severely that she suffered skull fractures and other serious physical injuries. The subject, who pleaded guilty to the charges, faces just under a year in jail, when he's sentenced in January. We hope he gets the full term. We were happy to see that Bella was taken in by the Erie County SPCA for care and rehabilitation and has been adopted by a new owner. There was no good news in the next report, though, as a 29-year-old Depew man also faces just under a year in jail for leaving his 3-year-old bulldog, Goon, inside a hot car, where he died of heat stroke. It appears the suspect was shopping at Walmart for more than an hour on September 16th and left Goon in a cage in the rear cargo area of his vehicle. Temperatures were in the low 80s that day. A necropsy, an autopsy, indicated that the dog died from heat stroke due to impaired thermal regulation. In both cases, prosecutors requested that the court imposed an order prohibiting the defendants from owning, harboring, or having custody or control of any animals while the case is pending prosecution. Too little, too late, but it's something. A memorial. Irma Lorraine Nowak. May 20th, 1930 to November 16th, 2025. Irma Lorraine Nee Fisher Nowak passed away peacefully on November 16th, 2025 at Newfane Rehab and Health Care Center. Irma was born in Buffalo to the late Edward and Jesse Fisher. She was known for Irma's Alcott Bowl and Irma's Coney Island Restaurant. She also worked as a licensed practical nurse at Beechwood. Irma is best remembered for her warm, engaging, and upbeat personality. She was known to always be hardworking, strong-willed, and kind and generous. She is predeceased by her late husband, Raymond Nowak. Irma is survived by her daughter, Michelle Rogene Stiers, two grandchildren, Sterling and Jordan, her brother David Fisher, and two nieces, as well as her second family at Newfane Rehab. Please join the family in a celebration of life. Well, this passed, but you can think about her in your prayers. If you knew her, perhaps send some condolences to the family. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from current issues of the Lockport Union Sun and Journal. Your reader has been P. Fitz. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Wall Street Journal off-duty section. At 7 o'clock, we got Harper's Magazine, and at 8 o'clock, we have Sports Illustrated. Stay tuned for these readings and more throughout the day. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Radio readers broadcast daily readings, 24 hours a day, of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. A broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio reading broadcasts throughout the city of Buffalo, western New York, and southern Ontario's Niagara Peninsula. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or